What is happening is that I do both things here. Obviously, I teach, talk to students, have meetings, the university meetings, planning things for the Complex Systems Institute to become larger and expand the mission. And at the same time, I'm trying to run things back home in Bosnia. Through meetings, conversations, emails, and such. What is happening is that we are learning the ropes of this electoral process, election processes. One peculiarity of elections in Bosnia and Herzegovina is this election of, they call them election boards, boards that are overseeing elections at each, what do they call it?
Voting precincts or what, yeah.
Precincts, right. There is a big battle to be on it. Every party gets, and I know we talked a little bit about this, every party gets a certain number of places where you can have your representatives. And then these established parties start exchanging, swapping places with others who might not have big interest in that place where they got, but they have interest in the other place where they did not get their representatives, so they keep swapping. And the parties who don't want the integrity of the election process to be maintained, they simply encourage people to swap places, and then sometimes you really buy them off and say, just don't show up, please. And then the authorities in that city, county have the right to replace the people who don't show up the day of election for their duty. They are paid. There are two kinds of people there. Those who are members of the election committees or boards, and they are paid by the government $30 or so for that day to be there. And there are others who are called observers. And we have, each political party can have observers, probably a limited number, of the various the observers of the process, and can really be in the room with the election committee or board, but cannot count, but just observe the process. Those people, if parties want to have them, are paid by the parties. So right now I'm talking about these memberships on the electoral boards. And obviously, we, just like any other party, we got offers from others, other political parties, to participate in that swapping process, and we refused on the basis of principle. We said, no, that's not part of the integrity of the electoral process, of the elections. We don't want that. We have principles. We obey and abide by these principles. We live by those principles. No, we don't. It's tremendous pressure, conversations from the our people on the ground who are basically saying, listen, we are losing because of this. Yes, we will lose occasional seat, and they will think we are naive, but we will show by the example that it's, even if it's at our expense, we will follow the rules. Many conversations like that. Then there are regions where those personal animosities pop up, or positioning for various roles, and some of them become public, some of them just simmer under the surface, and there was a lot of need for some PR work this past week, where we had to respond to inaccurate representation in the media of our processes and who we are. There are many it boils down to personnel situations. I just had a meeting with one of our regions, the Northwest side region, Una, where somebody, where the head of the region, just today had to step down for health reasons from that role, and the who is also the candidate for the mayor of the city of Bihać. Had to step down from his role as a president of the regional board, but not as a candidate for the mayorship. But had a major health scare and has to go through some significant recovery. But it is also great when I call the meeting of his board, and he shows up, even though, and that's a great love and respect for the process and for the idea, where he shows up for the meeting, just in person, inform people that he really cannot. And it required a great deal of courage on his part to do so. And that gives you also some, encourages you in this whole process of political battle for the better future of Bosnia and Herzegovina. Events in a neighboring country, Montenegro, continuing to influence events in Bosnia and Herzegovina because of the fact that nationalists over there, Serbian nationalists in this particular case, seem to have won through some coalition the election, and that continues to have the effect on our elections. Also in various cities, we are seeing some alliances that of the nationalists. There are three kinds of nationalists here we talk about, and now suddenly we are seeing the two uniting against the third one. And all these events are happening that just send the picture of a place where people don't matter, where laws don't matter, where the country doesn't matter, where all it is about is this, the fight and holding on to the power, fight for and holding on to the power, which in the end brings really not as influence, but also huge financial rewards. And you see this, the unholy alliance of religious organizations, specific parties. One, that in every in Bosnia, there is, of course, one nation, but there are, they call it three peoples, three different ethnic groups, many ethnic groups, but three major ones. And in each ethnic group, there are several parties, but there's always one, the ruling one, that establishes this, what I call, unholy alliance with religious institutions. And that becomes something that's really hard to break, because the church or the mosque, they have the hold on or power over the spiritual side of people, and they truly believe that that's the representatives of God are saying that thing. And here you have the political side that is controlling the norm, the regular life of citizens, of people through jobs and so on. And that link between the two is so powerful that every time you need something, a message, it's going to come from the spiritual or from the worldly side, and people feel like captured. You cannot get out of that bind. The church, the mosque, religious organizations are becoming so political. But in, to me, it is in the worst possible way, because religion is supposed to be above politics. I know it's always political, but above politics in the sense that I want to influence all, not just one party, all the citizens. But here it's almost you take this, you give away this tremendous power that you have as the head of a religious organization, for example. You have a tremendous power over all the people, over all the believers who believe in that approach to religion or to God. But then you give that to one party, even among you people, quote unquote, one party. And by doing that, I think they diminish their potential influence. In exchange for everything that that one party will give them, special considerations, allocation of land, tax benefits, whatever. And somehow it has played out in this part of the world in a very powerful way, but in the worst sense of that word powerful. That is not in the interest of people. Even those who are in that church, in that mosque, or in that political party, or in that ethnic group. I don't know how does it reflect itself in any other place in the world. We are seeing something like it in the United States, but not as much, not to that same extent. But the other day I was talking to somebody who said something that was really, really interesting. And he said this, see what's happening in the world. All these dictators popping up through democratic processes. And that person said, I think some of it at least started here in ex-Yugoslavia during the 92 and the 95, the war, the whatever you call it, aggression, depending on sides who are talking about this. And they said, when the world saw that these dictators, nationalists, who became acquainted with religious zealots or with church or with mosque and suddenly created that alliance between the nationalistic policy on the one hand and the religious organizations on the other. That played out itself in Bosnia and result in Yugoslavia and specifically in Bosnia and resulted in genocide, divisions, hatred, death, ethnic cleansing, and so on. And the world rewarded it. Didn't punish it. Bosnia got divided according to these ethnic lines. Ethnic cleansing was institutionalized. Those who are responsible for genocide got part of the country. And the place where the genocide happened is in that part of the country. The world saw that it was just fine. And now you have Orban in Hungary, a situation where dictators pop up. You have similar situation in Poland. Turkey became like that. It didn't start like that. Of course, Soviet Union and now Russia is a completely different story. But you have Brazil, you have all of these people popping up everywhere, and I don't know whether that was, I know Bosnia and Herzegovina or Yugoslavia was not that important, or not a big deal for the world, it's small. But there's a message that the world community will allow it to happen. It's just amazing. And we saw subsequently the rise of the right, that simply saw the path to the power by simply saying, I don't have to represent all of the people, I can represent some, and if those can keep me in power. And now we see that everywhere. Presidents, representatives are basically saying, it is okay to preside over a divided country as long as I have the majority. And I don't have to be just. I just have to be convincing enough to convey the message to those that will vote for me that I will protect their interests. Yes, at the expense of everybody else in the country. Is it true or not that Bosnia or Yugoslavia had anything to do with it? I don't know. But I know that it was among the first where such a thing played itself out and that others got an interesting message. So that trend is continuing. I don't see that the world is capable of responding to it. I don't see the organizations like NATO or the European Union or whatever as capable of responding to such a threat. And the conclusion seems to be that everything is really open, everything is possible now, which should send a message to all of us that in the end it's up to us. You cannot really rely anymore on the world order to protect you or anybody else, because everybody is out for themselves. Everybody's trying to figure out what and how to give back this sense of order to the world. And interestingly enough, after the breakup of the Soviet Union and when the Berlin Wall fell down, went down, was brought down, the void was created because this bipolar world, the East versus West, kept things in check on both sides. And now suddenly there was no enemy. And I think this is still the result of the world sorting things out, trying to find the main levers of order. And we went from the enemies, at some point was Islam, I don't know, at some point it was terrorist organizations, those who can access, perhaps have access to nuclear power, then became Islam, then it became, now became the right versus left. We are almost like in search for the enemy, search of the enemy that will stabilize the world and it will become bipolar again. And this seems like a transitory period waiting for something else to emerge. The United States as a superpower is not as powerful, at least economically, as it used to be. China is rising, India is rising. European Union is trying to figure out where it wants to go. Soviet Union, Russia is trying to figure out, trying to get back into the world politics and be the superpower that they are not right now. The United States still is the largest, is the greatest economy and the largest power in the world, but it doesn't command the respect that it used to. So we are really open for a lot of turbulence, a lot of changes. And this right battle, the battle right now is, I see the right versus left. And the right is much more, much better organized than the left. And the, I want to say that the left, left in terms of values is not finding its footing in the battle against the right. And so we're seeing the right succeeding in many countries now. But it is, it's going to take some international organization, movement, and coordination that will reestablish some kind of sense of the order. And I don't see it really happening at this point, but I know it's going to have to come. And in that context, Bosnia will have to find way how to survive and move toward better in the midst of this chaos.
But I mean, knowing all this, and this, you explain it so well, how does this, one, I guess, is there continued frustration on your part knowing that this is how it is, but how does it impact moving forward with your messaging now, but with the presidential election coming up in 2 years, moving forward? I mean, does it change anything, or you just have to proceed the way you have?
Well, it changes a lot to me. The reason I think about these issues is because you're looking for solutions within the context in which you operate, live, act. And when it comes to the presidential race, which is 2 years from now, unlike local elections today, you really have to offer the path to better future to the citizens. And you have to put it in the context of the surroundings and the trends. And if you basically say, we're going to align ourselves with these countries, with these powers, you have to know with which power. Do you align yourself with anybody? With whom? What can you expect? If you align yourself economically or politically or in any other way, what can you expect in exchange for that? Can you really have an economic hope at all? Will the people continue leaving? Will the people come back? Will you succeed? Bosnia is dependent on the neighbors, on the nature of the political and economic situation in the neighboring countries of Serbia, Croatia. Right now, one Croatia is in European Union, has territorial still demands or pretensions, aspirations toward Bosnia-Herzegovina. Serbia on the east is not in European Union, but is aligning herself with Russia and sometimes with the United States and European Union. So we are already in the world global context, European Union and on the one hand and the United States, hopefully, and Russia on the other. And the United States is trying to basically influence this Western Balkan region to fend off the Russian infiltration. So we act in that context. And if you are running for president, you have to understand that context and basically say, here's what we should do. President Tito chose a non-alignment movement. He chose not the left or the right. He chose the third side. He recreated the third side, non-alignment movement, and a lot of African and Asian countries joined him, which opened markets for Yugoslav economy. What do we do now? Because in the end is going to have economic consequences, tremendous economic consequences. So, therefore, you really have to understand. And it is not a moment of despair or losing hope, but increased challenge to basically figure out how do we move forward. Can you really reduce or eliminate nationalistic fervor in the country if the origins are not inside, but just outside in the neighboring countries? How do we fight that battle if you don't fight the other battle, political, against what's happening in the other neighboring countries who are doing everything they can to destabilize Bosnia-Herzegovina to the point that they want the world community to believe that Bosnia-Herzegovina is not a possible country. They are doing everything to prove that it's not a possible country. So it is a huge task. It's a challenge. It's a huge responsibility, but at the same time, huge opportunity to act on the world scene by acting in your local village. And that's what I tend to do.
Well, it's, and knowing you, it's like, yes, it's a challenge, but these are the kind of challenges that you thrive on too.
Right.
And it plays right into how your mind works. And so talk about that just a little bit, because maybe perhaps you would prefer not to have this challenge to deal with, but now you've got it. You really focus in on the whys and how to deal with it.
Well, I'm not a masochist. I don't want pain. Just for the sake of pain. But it is true that the greater the challenge, the more appealing it is to me when it comes to my own engagement. I was reading yesterday, don't know where it came from, New York Times or whatever, an article about what people want in life. It wasn't New York Times, it was something else. But the normal assumption is that people want happiness. They want to just want to be happy. What is it that we are striving for? We just want to be happy. And in that article, they were talking about exactly that. Well, most people want to be happy, and this is how you actually go about doing it. How do you create a country that offers that, such a thing? And it actually made me pause and look at that sentence. And I said, is it really true? Would I really be happy if I just smiled every second of my life and just had that sense of pleasure, right? Oh, it's fine, it's cool. When I read, I don't smile, I'm not happy. I just love the process of reading. And I'm learning. When I'm learning something, I love the fact that I'm learning, because there's greater level of capability for you to accomplish something. Accomplishing something is not a sense of happiness. It's a sense of, I want to accomplish something. And you feel, you can say, I'm proud of the fact that I did it. Oh, it was a thrill going through the process. I know it was hard. And the harder it was, the greater the thrill in the end. In the context, why are we here and what are we trying to do? What makes life worth living and fulfilling? Comes even the concept of challenge. Really, the greater level of challenge, the greater sense of accomplishment. And I don't know that people want to have more challenges thrown their way. But I know that once something is done, the sense of accomplishment is greater with every additional challenge that was thrown your way as you went about doing what you set out to do. So it's is with me as well. I do appreciate the fact that if it's really, really hard, then A, it's more worth doing, B, the sense of accomplishment is greater, and then preparation for the next stage is better.
Yeah.
Because every new stage has even more difficult set of challenges ahead of you. So yeah, I'm not going to shy away. I'm not afraid of them. But it has to influence the way you think about the issue.
Well, just one more, because you had said eyes were paying attention to what's going on in Montenegro, but we're also hearing a lot recently, the last couple of weeks, in Belarus. Now, is there any influence of what's going on there that would influence Bosnia and Herzegovina, or it's just kind of there? I mean, I see some similarities as to what's going on. That's why I ask.
Right. There are many similarities. It is inspiring what is happening in Belarus, because people decided to rise up and say enough is enough. And in that sense, I'm really hoping that the message to the people of Bosnia and Herzegovina will be, yeah, it's possible. It's possible to make changes simply by not being afraid to raise your voice and say, here's what I think. I don't like this. I'm not going to put up with this anymore. I am just hoping that these things will just nudge people into action. One result would be, even if they didn't want to go out in the streets, which is harder in the day of Corona, at least they could decide to vote in greater numbers, in larger numbers, to a greater extent. Right now, projections are for 52-53%, just they always are. And it's less for local elections, in low 40s. But if we decide, if the people decide to basically do it at a level of 75%, we have a different ballgame. And it's our job, not just our platform for progress, but all the parties, except for those who are in power. They don't want a lot of people to vote. They want as few to vote as possible. I think all the other parties should work on the message, get out and vote, because it is important.
It's going to be another interesting 2 years for the platform in the country. I look forward to the future and what happens.
Thank you, man. I'm looking forward to that too. And I just hope that that we will get to that critical mass sooner rather than later, just to reduce the pain to the whole country. But thank you for your tremendous contribution.
Well, thank you.